Oh, okay. Because we have such a full house, I've asked my colleague Peter Henrikson to chair so that I can go and reinforce the benches of the members. So Peter will be taking us through the session this morning, and I'm going to hand over immediately to you, Peter, with the exception of one issue. Can I just check with the department these documents we can distribute? Okay. Lovely. Please, there are not too many copies, so Luella, just make sure that members, as they come in, because I'm sure many will come in late, receive the copies first and then hand out to others. Okay. Over to you, Peter.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning and welcome to everybody at this, which I think is the ultimate meeting of this Parliament with public enterprises. So please feel welcome. Just a notice in your interest. There's a little problem with the coffee flask over there. The hot water contains the coffee, and the unnamed flask contains the hot water. I found out the hard way. DJ, without any further ado, the floor is yours. Would you like to come sit up here or something?
No, quite comfortable, Chair.
Okay.
And it feels a little bit less hot on the side. Good morning to everyone. Good morning to the honourable members. I hope you have a good holiday. I've decided that I'm saying Happy New Year until March. It feels a little bit hectic this year. Chair, we've got three presentations that we'll make. One on SAA, and the SAA one is split in two. We will make from the department perspective, and also the chairman of SAA and the acting CEO with an executive team from SAA are also present. So they'll also make a presentation on SAA. We're proposing that we take an hour for those two presentations and the discussion. And then we also then have two other presentations, one on ESCOM, and there we'll focus on the guarantee fundamentally, but also give them an update on where we are at present. And then the last presentation is going to be around PBMR. Thank you, Jeff. I'll let Andrew Shaw begin.
Thank you very much, first of all, for the opportunity to present the Chair and honourable members. What I'd like to share with you this morning is just a brief overview of the shareholder perspective in respect of SAA. We'll go through some of the operational issues that SAA faces. We'll look at the global downturn and the impact that has on aviation generally. And then I'll look at issues such as equity and what has been proposed through the latest budget in respect of assistance to SAA. The first area to focus on is the operational environment. Now, I think it's very clear to all of us, having followed the financial press, that the world is faced with a considerable economic downturn, and this is evident in a number of sectors, but aviation has been severely impacted. Aviation has very small margins globally, and the impact is obviously very severe, and it's picked up quite often first in the aviation sector before it's really as effective in other sectors. Passenger demand as a consequence has fallen off very rapidly since 2008, August, September, and I'll show you some evidence of that. And as the global financial crisis has intensified, you'll see that the drops have been very dramatic. Passengers carried on the markets between South Africa, the USA and Europe, where predominantly this recession is now focused, but also in India, have since September reduced substantially. We've also seen passenger reductions in the domestic market, but not quite as dramatic as in the global or the intercontinental market. Interestingly, the African regional market has over the same period, seen traffic increase. Now, this may be something where the African market has still got to catch up with the global market, but it means that the profitability on the African market has assisted SAA to improve its overall financial position. However, 60% of SAA's revenues are derived in the intercontinental market, which is the market that's struggling the most. This graph here shows year-on-year quarterly passenger growth So this is just growth. On the left-hand side, you can see the percentages of growth as they're measured. It is for passengers through O.R. Tambo International Airport, so it focuses on just the primary hub in South Africa. What you can see, if you look towards the use of pointer, if you look towards that position there, you'll see the very dramatic fall-off that we're talking about. The red line indicates intercontinental or traffic coming from international destinations, and the blue line indicates traffic from domestic destinations. And this is traffic for all the carriers in South Africa, so this is not specific to SAA. This is just a general market picture. So obviously the downturn affects all the carriers in the same way, and they're all in a position where they're struggling to...
Excuse me. Sorry. Just on a point of order, just to note that we have a member here who is visually impaired. So if I know it's difficult, but in the presentation, if you could describe it a little bit more, it would help.
Okay, my apologies. Let me be a little clearer about this. I think what we see is that since August, September, we've seen traffic growth move into the negative territory. So for the first time since 2001, we are seeing a decline in average volume of traffic coming through Gautier. And we now, on the intercontinental side, we're now close to a 14% reduction since the period of about March 2008. So just to give you a sense of where SAA has come from in terms of the restructuring plan, in 2007, March 2007, SAA failed to meet going concern requirements, and so a restructuring plan was introduced into the business that had an 18-month time frame. The objective was to improve SAA's operational competitiveness. The focus was on cost reduction, and also reducing the company and its network of operations, so its route network. And as a consequence, we saw the grounding of 747 aircraft. We also saw pullback in certain international destinations. The restructuring plan included a number of elements, including, as I've said, the 747 grounding, organizational realignment, head office staff reductions and voluntary severance packages, cost reductions and simplification of procedures, a review of contracts, including the unwinding of certain onerous legacy contracts. However, there are still certain contracts in the business that remain, onerous contracts, and an improvement in revenue and yield management. And the focus there was to improve average revenue per passenger. I expect SAA will take us into a little bit further detail in the next presentation about the actual details of the impact of the restructuring. We through the shareholder, the plan was funded by the transfer of $653 million, and this was used for labor restructuring. This supported the voluntary severance package process. And so being a voluntary process, people were able to put forward a request to leave SAA, and as a consequence of this, they were paid out money that was due to them. There was also a guarantee of $1.56 billion that I'll come back to later because it relates to the amounts that have been talked of in the recent budget. The focus of the 1.56 is for the grounding of the 747 aircraft. The restructuring achieved a cost saving of $1.14 billion by March 2008. This is a considerable cost restructuring, and SAA really should be complimented for their ability to actually achieve cost restructuring of this to this extent. It actually achieved a restructuring or cost restructuring that was in excess of what was budgeted for through the restructuring plan. However, in respect of organizational realignment, there were some challenges that emerged from the restructuring process. Part of the restructuring involved corporatization or outsourcing or the selection of strategic equity partners for a number of business areas. Voyager, which is the frequent flyer mileage program, SAA Technical, catering, and potentially air freight, although air freight was at a later stage through the restructuring was rethought as an intrinsic part of the business. There have been some quite considerable improvements in revenue management, but these have tended to lag the objectives of the restructuring plan, so maybe not quite have achieved the restructuring targets that were set out for them. So the cost-saving targets were exceeded, but in terms of revenue management, some of the targets were not entirely fully met. While average fares have increased as a result of better revenue management, load factors have declined, and that's really a consequence of the general economic downturn that we now face, and is really challenging for the business going forward. As I said, the international business environment is very challenging. We've seen 35 medium-sized airlines go into liquidation in the last year. Medium-sized airlines are particularly exposed. We've seen a number of African carriers go into liquidation, a number of US carriers go into liquidation, and we've also seen government support increase to a number of the larger carriers. IATA forecasts for the airline industry indicate that 2009 is going to be another very tough year. So it doesn't look like the recession is going to it looks like the recession is going to be with us for another few years. The traffic markets are, as a consequence, expected to fall a little further. The reduction in costs are offset by a larger reduction in prices and yields. So what we see is that published capacity plans in the airline industry, and when we say capacity, we're talking about the number of aircraft that are put on routes in various networks across the world. We've seen sharp cutbacks in this. So many airlines have done exactly what SAA have done. They've grounded aircraft. They've grounded particularly the older aircraft. They've grounded the less efficient aircraft. There are huge numbers of aircraft in the market at the moment that are underutilized or unutilized. And so a number of airlines have followed very similar cost-cutting measures to SAA in its restructuring program. So it's very clear that SAA is exactly on the right target. The question is, can we sustain further cost-cutting going forward? So if we look at the global aviation, and this really matches very much to the previous graph that I demonstrated to you for what is happening at Oliver Tambo International, we see internationally that passenger RPKs, which are revenue passenger kilometers, have declined dramatically, as is air freight. A dramatic decline in these two areas. And it's expected that some of this decline will continue, or at least bottom out before improving maybe in 2 to 3 years' time. We've also seen capacity, as I've said, drop significantly, particularly in the U.S. market, which has been the most severely impacted by the recession. Asia-Pacific region has been much less impacted by the recessionary environment, but capacity has dropped off dramatically, as you can see, from October 2008 until now. And that's actually the reduction or the removal of aircraft from the network, as I indicated previously. Part of the challenge that SAA faces is that it's very severely undercapitalized. And I apologize for those of you who are not even visually impaired. It's very difficult to see on the slide where SAA lies. But if you look at that point there, that is SAA. That bar there indicates that we have an on and off balance sheet debt situation, which is in the region of just above 1,400% debt to equity ratio, which is really very astronomical. SAA is almost more indebted than the average American. That's how bad it is. These other airlines over here, you can see their debt-to-equity situation is much better. And so they're in a much more sustainable position. When it comes to an economic downturn, they actually have a little bit of, if you like, fat in the system. They're able to deal with a downturn in a much more sustainable manner. The challenge for us as a shareholder is, how do you improve the equity position of SAA to enhance its sustainability over time? Now, the funds and the guarantees that have been transferred to SAA since it has been transferred from Transnet to government are shown on this slide. The first is a subordinated loan, which is shown at the top of the table. That's for an amount of $1.3 billion, and this was cash that was ring-fenced and it was provided as a result of the going concern problems at the end of the 2007 financial year. And it is not in the form of direct cash. It is in the form of a guarantee, and we'll come back to this problem later. The next amount of money is $653 million, and this was directly allocated for the voluntary severance packages, in other words, to reduce the staff complement of SAA. The final amount is the $1.56 billion, which again is a guarantee, and this guarantee was used to ground the 747 aircraft. So what is clear from this is that the total cash injection to SAA since its transfer from Transnet is $653 million. And the total guarantee amount over that same period is $2.86 million. Now, the implication of providing guarantees to SAA is what we do is we actually just increase that debt position still further. We make the company less sustainable. We make the interest payments that the company is forced to make on a monthly basis more and more astronomical, and it becomes a less and less sustainable business. And this is the problem that we have from an equity position within SAA. The conversion of the 1.56 billion from quasi-equity to full equity is what has been put forward in the most recent budget. When these guarantees were first issued, they were issued as guarantees which enabled SAA to go to a bank to raise loan finance, which they would then have to pay interest payments on, but they were put in the books of SAA as equity. So it looked very much from an outsider perspective as though we were increasing the equity position of SAA, where in fact what we were doing is we were increasing the debt position of SAA. The conversion of this 1.56 billion from a guarantee to a equity or full equity injection actually means that we reduce the debt obligation. Not substantially, but we reduce it partially. So this creates at least a slightly improved equity position. The left-hand side of the slide really demonstrates what I've already indicated to you, which was that there's two guarantee amounts, the 1.3 and the 1.56. And the right-hand side indicates the benefits of shifting the 1.56 from a guarantee to full equity. Obviously, SAA has found itself in a challenging position now for a number of years, and there really is a very severe need for a strategic change of direction. We're in a challenging market environment. SAA is really very inadequately positioned to deal with this recent turbulence in the market. It's a small carrier in comparison to many of the other global carriers. It remains very thinly capitalized, as I've indicated to you. The 1.56 conversion is really insufficient, but it's a very strong beginning to improving the equity position of the airline. It's clear to us as a shareholder that the culture of dependence on government has to be reversed. We can't have a situation where SAA returns for significant amounts of money in the future. The airline really needs to trade itself out of profitability, and there are indications that SAA is moving in this direction, but the constraints of undercapitalization remain. The restructuring program, as I've said, has reduced costs, but revenue and route profitability do remain ongoing challenges as we move forward. Route profitability needs to be comprehensively assessed, and the airline needs to adapt much more agilely in the face of market-related changes. Support services need to be converted to profit centers, as was proposed under the restructuring plan. This process has been slow to move. The pace of this process really needs to be rapidly improved. And operationally, the airline requires additional skills and expertise, particularly in respect of SAA technical, where we've seen dramatic losses in expertise, and it's an area that really is a skill shortage. However, there's a number of immediate challenges that do need to be addressed. The Voyager liability, which is the miles program, through accounting legislation or accounting guidance, now has to be reflected on the SAA's balance sheet. The Voyager liability in this respect does need to be resolved. Negotiations with Airbus for the order that was placed in 2002, so some considerable time back, need to be finalised, and we need to move forward in respect of what are the aircraft that are required, where will they be used in the airline. We need to resolve all outstanding competition matters. There are a number of outstanding litigation issues in respect of the US, the EU, as well as Australia, in respect of past competition-related issues where SAA is implicated that need to be resolved. We also need to renegotiate all the internal supplier contracts in such a way that we can make the company sit at arm's length from those areas that are not regarded as core elements of the business. And that's the end of the presentation, and so I'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Should I shift directly to the SAA presentation?
Chair, the core issues that we were raising here is that with the one point, the object of going for conversion of a guarantee. Now that is an equity, and it's quasi equity is an equity instrument, so it does effectively change the equity of the organisation, the guarantee as we had used it previously. But the issue is, and we've raised this before with the committee, that guarantees are an instrument which have a cost attached to themselves, and you're going to the market and raise debts on top of, additional debts on top of those, which then further have the effect of increasing the cost of for the enterprise. And so, to a large extent, what we were trying to do was going for a cheaper instrument, effectively by converting the the conversion of the guarantee into a straight cash injection. The one core one of the issues that we also raised in here, which is around the need to move the airline, frankly, to generally operate as a commercial enterprise, means that over and above being able to trade itself in, out of trouble when it's in trouble, but frankly also having shareholders able to support it, as other airlines around the world are going to have shareholders and states supporting them as well. Is the other point is, are we in South Africa really ready for an airline that makes quick, sharp decisions about route changes if it's not profitable? In a downturn like this, are we ready for having sudden reductions in volumes into particular markets if there isn't sufficient business on those markets? Because if effectively you say that the airline can't do those sorts of things, then you must understand that what we are saying is that we should take the risk that even in conditions where they should be cutting back their operations, they continue their operations because there's an expectation that they will not behave in a commercially rational manner. Our position as a shareholder is that we have no option but for the airline to move in that direction. I'll ask the CEO and the chairman to present us there. Apologies, Chair. We didn't inform it there to make copies, so what we'll do is we'll make the copies available later.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm just going to make a few introductory remarks and then my colleague, the executive, will do the presentation. Let me just say thank you very much for this opportunity to present to this, our parent committee. This is a very opportune time also to be doing that. There's been so much sound and fury around the airline and about matters around the airline that nationally we might have lost sight of how well this airline is actually doing in the circumstances and within a global context. And I hope that the presentation of my colleague is going to point out some of that. But this is not, and Andrew has done, I think, a marvelous presentation about what the airline is about and what it's doing. And it's not to underplay in any way the enormity of the challenges and the difficulties facing the airline, facing airlines in the world generally. We've seen how many airlines have gone down. So my colleagues will do the presentation, but I could just make these few remarks before they get into that. I often ask myself when I listen to us as a nation, what is it with us that we tend so often to turn on ourselves? And I think about the airline too. This is actually a great airline that we have. But as with so many other things in national life, we seem to have this propensity of turning on ourselves. So that's actually a great airline. We're doing very well in the global context, and my colleagues will show comparative figures. Airlines are going down, but we are, except for the matters that Andrew also raised, very well positioned, better positioned than most in the world. I hope we can, and Andrew's already started doing that, can dispel this notion, and again, how media is able to make a national metaphor. This constant reference to the taxpayer bailing out the airline. Now, Andrew has referred to our capital structure, and we will evolve that, and he's shown what the airline has got from Treasury over a certain period. So we really need to revisit that concept of an airline being bailed out by the taxpayer. As Andrew has shown, our restructuring had been quite successful in most respects. What the company needs is recapitalization like any company. I really need to take this opportunity also to thank the management and the staff of South African Airways. They come under constant barrage, but they've done a marvelous job of bringing the airline to the point where it now is. And I introduce to you Chris Smythe, the recently appointed acting CEO of the company, to lead the presentation, and he will introduce his colleagues as we go on. Thanks very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Cavill, and thank you for those words. As Dr. Shaw has very clearly indicated, South African Airways does face major challenges going forward, particularly from the economic downturn perspective, and it does so with a real constraint from its thin capital base, its capital structure inadequacy. My team and I's message to you today is more around operations, and it's our mission today to show to you, to prove to you, that SAA is in fact in a very healthy position as far as its operational side is concerned, as far as it being and operating as an airline is concerned. I'd like to, if I can, take that. I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce to you my team. On my right is our Chief Financial Officer, Kaushik Patel. On his right is our General Manager of Human Resources, Babalaji Balunga. Directly behind me is Vera Creel, who will assist with this presentation. Vera is Head of Corporate Strategy. On her left is Robin Chalmers, Head of Group Corporate Affairs. And we have another member, I'm not too sure who's joined us yet. Nombulan Kabindi was delayed in her flight. She is in charge of sales and marketing. This presentation will take the following form. We will talk you through airports and flight operational performance, followed by the current status of our restructuring initiatives. Which we'll hope to show to you that we've actually used the restructuring initiative to turn the airline around and position it in a far better position now than it was a year ago to face the economic meltdown. We'll show you some market performance which bears that out. And then finally, we'll discuss some customer service delivery statistics, mainly independent measurements and reviews of customer perceptions of SAA. If we can move to the next slide, please. I think most airlines measure their operational performance on a number of statistics, but more primarily on what we call OTP, or on-time performance. And this is, I think, where SAA has seen a remarkable success over the last couple of years. This slide, unfortunately, is quite busy and it's difficult to read, and I'll try and take you through it step by step. If you look at the bottom, on the left-hand side, you'll see a line that's a light blue line, marked 2006, and you'll see that it started at around 82% and declined towards April. There's a slight rise towards May, which is normally a low month for us, and then it progressively declined. And over the years, each year after that, tended to be slightly worse, culminating in a real disaster last year. If you look at the purple line, we were running below 55% on-time performance. To be fair, I would like to point out to the honourable members that was the time that SAA and the other airlines at all South African airports were required to change handlers because of a re-tender that was put out by the airport company in South Africa. But since then, members, you'll see that the line has climbed steadily. And since about September, it's passed our target, and it's passed every year since 2006. We're now currently running at on-time performance that we've not seen in the recorded track record in the past so far, which is closing on 90%. Now, one might ask the question, how has this been achieved? And it's been achieved through three different ways. One is the change in handlers that I referred to before. We're now working with the airport and with other handlers at the airport who are committed and who are professional in their approach. And I have to say that this has been helped by a combined effort, by collective effort throughout the airport structures. And that would include the management and the staff of the airport company in South Africa as well. The second approach is a concentrated focus on the operational side of the business. We measure on a daily basis, and we react as soon as those measurements throw up or highlight a problem. Whereas before, there wasn't that much in the way of measurement of what went on. Measurements, I think, are proving to be the key for SAA's management of its operations. And the third way is that we have embraced technology, and we will continue to embrace technology going forward. I think the members will find that over the next couple of the years, the aviation industry, the airline industry itself, will see major technological changes that will change the way people go through airports. and not necessarily limited to airlines, but also to customs, to security, and to everything that touches customers at the airport. These are a couple of slides that show you where our technological involvement has shown some returns. In the old days, well, in the old days, 2-3 years ago, all boarding was done manually. We now use automatic boarding gate readers, which allow for a much more consistent and speedy boarding process. And you will see over the months how each of the airports has improved. Some better than others, but there has been a noteworthy improvement in the use of boarding gate readers. You'll see also that a concerted effort in the other area that SAA has taken an enormous amount of flak for, and that was in the mishandled baggage. You'll see that mishandled baggage has improved by roughly 20% over the time. What I haven't shown here is that the more emotive issue of baggage pilferage has shown a roughly a 40% decline. I would also remind that SAA itself doesn't have too much involvement in the handling of baggage. Its partners do most of the handling, and I think the ability to change partners has led to these improvements, and we're very grateful for that. I would also say that SAA is not yet where it wants to be. At the moment, the level of pilferage is still above international norms. It is 40% down, but it needs to go to at least another 20% down. Another area we use technology is in self-service and web check-in. We are able to offer our passengers the ability to check in from home on their computers and to print their boarding passes. At the moment, this is only available in some offshore areas such as Mauritius, Hong Kong, and more are coming online. It is not yet available in South Africa, but it will be available in this country fairly soon. There are some concerns amongst authorities about forgery and copying of boarding passes, but those are being ironed out as we speak. I'd like to hand over to my colleague, Vera Creel, now to talk you through the restructuring.
Thank you, Chair. The restructuring, I will concentrate on some of the impact that the restructuring has. The first slide is a summary slide that I've already shared by Dr. Shaw in terms of how the restructuring was put together in terms of the initiative, so I won't spend too much time on that. I will rather move on to the next slide, which is a confirmation again by year-end March 2008 that the restructuring program has ended 3% above target, and the figure that was mentioned already was that the delivery of 1.1 billion in cost savings were achieved. The next slide is actually the more important slide because it's the most recent performance as of the end of December. As you will know, the restructuring program, the 18-month program, coming to an end this March, formally. We have been actually in the 9 months delivered the cost savings that was projected for the year to the amount of 2.3 billion. And to that effect, it's almost 34% to 35% above target as of the end of December. Now, that was achieved through the various initiatives, and the next slide will show you that in terms of the real numbers, that brings us to the 2.3 billion. Various areas were responsible and accountable to deliver these targets as of the end of December. The first area is the HR area, which is the only area that's slightly behind with a 2%, which is more or less a 9 million behind target. Main reason for this is that we're still in negotiations on standardization of conditions of service that will bring some of those savings into the fold. If not this financial year, definitely next financial year, because it's a sustainable cost saving. In addition to that, we have also did some compromises in the negotiation to achieve a 3-year wage deal that was the first in the SAA history. So there were a bit of compromises to get a longer-term good deal for the airline as a business. The other areas, operations, you can see has delivered, just despite the fact that HR is 2% behind. They are one in terms of real nominal value, one of the largest areas that contributed to savings of 550 million. Operations is ahead of target by 20% and delivering up to year end December 173 million cost savings. Those are made up of initial identified initiatives, but also what the business has done right through, and not only in operations, identify other sustainable cost savings initiatives that will take us not only now, but into the next financial year. Then on the finance side, you'll see a big sum was delivered of 489 million, and that is 70% above target. I will talk about the 747s in the next slide, but also finance had a bit of challenges, but brought some additional initiatives in their own areas to the table to make up the target. Then technical. Technical was primarily around contract negotiation to basically not just accept the first price people give us. There was some very good results in that, and I brought to the table 156 million, more or less. Cargo was a small area, but have also overachieved by winning 36 million. And then communications, small budget, but if you look at the percentage that they brought, a big percentage of 3 million. Business development, and under business development, just for information purposes, those are the areas of our network, our pricing, our scheduling. And they have brought together 330 million. Those were initiatives in the revenue management and scheduling area, specifically around pricing, competitive pricing, and also network enhancements to improve connectivity that obviously increased our revenue. Sales and marketing, and we're quite proud of sales and marketing because it has moved into the green, you know, from November last year into over delivery. There was a lot of hard work, a lot of the initiatives in sales and marketing was lagging behind initially. They've caught up, and some of the initiatives in terms of especially like the share gap where we lagged behind in Africa and in domestic has been closed and even started to over deliver. It does take some time to when you implement some of these initiatives to actually see the gains, and that has now started to happen. So overall, like I said, 35% increase. What is important, you will ask me, you know, are we just ourselves auditing ourselves to say this is what we've achieved? We have brought in independent auditors to look at these savings. So it isn't just our view that these savings have been achieved. The next slide, I want to highlight some of the changes to the initial program. When we last spoke to the committee in June last year, there were still of these initiatives that we reported on. The major changes were on these three big ones, the grounding of the 747. Now, the initial business case is because it was a very small sub-fleet with the high operational cost, and it wasn't making profits on the specific route that we had at that stage, which were Paris. It needed to be grounded. And the whole idea was not to only ground it, and then through mitigation was to keep the aircraft back or to sell or to sublease again. As mentioned by Dr. Shaw, you will realize that in the current economic conditions, it was very difficult to get people interested in these aircraft, and especially also because they are a bit more fuel hungry than some of the other aircraft. So what has happened is that we have, as mitigation actions, have put this fleet to use for a TARC lease. Now, TARC is the Angolan airline, and we have wet leased some of the aircraft to them, which has brought in the mitigation money, as well as we are now using them on the Lagos and Luanda flights, because from a profitability point of view, they can deliver those profits. And the question is, was it the right decision to initially ground them? From an operational point of view, the operational improvements have been shown, and we have seen 177 million year-to-date operational improvement by this first grounding and then moving it into these specific routes where we can get the revenue. On the next one was that we had a big number to deliver on some of our partnership relationships that we had to negotiate, and that has come to a bit of a stall, but what we have done is that we've actually replaced it with additional network changes and improvements and other co-share agreements. So again, we were able to claw back that initial money. Then the last one was also a big number, GDS cost. The GDS is Global Distribution System cost. The initial business case was that we paying too much per segment for the cost, and that we should negotiate it down. And it has transpired that we don't have all that much bargaining power with these systems, so we are still bringing it down, but not as much as that we thought initially. And again, what we've done then is that we've actually reduced some promotional advertising spend to bring it in line so that we can still make the savings. Just wanted to highlight those three to you. And that is on the restructuring. Just in summary then, what I was saying, I think SAA was definitely very fortunate that we started the restructuring program in a buoyant market. We were able to negotiate and do stuff that other airlines started doing about 12 months after we started our program, and so we did have what I call almost a first mover advantage in that sense, and that helped us. We are above target, and what the success of the restructuring plan is seen in the operating profit. We are, like mentioned previously by the acting CEO, we are on an operating level, and which we've always worked to from a restructuring program, are in the green. And I think the next step was that also there was discussions that the restructuring program has now become embedded as part of operations. It's not run separately anymore, though we've monitored it separately. It is part of the operations now. It's a way of life for people on these initiatives. But what we also said in the current economic conditions, the principles that we have embedded through the restructuring we're taking forward, and that is the strong focus on cost containment. One of the things that we've put in place immediately when we were in really big trouble was the cash conservation office. We still have that cash conservation office, but now a part of the integrated structure of the CFO, where every cent, even if you have budget, it gets relooked and questioned whether it is really needed to either support the business or the customer. So that's the one area. Then constantly seeking better ways of the to improve our efficiencies with our business improvement program that we have wrapped now into, you know, the what extended restructuring program, if we could call that, and then the focus on proper contract negotiations to make sure that we don't accept the first price that comes to the table for from a supplier point of view. And we've had some successes, but it's the mindset more than just the practicality. So it's about that. So that is on the impact of the restructuring. I want to share with you just some of the market performance. And I'm talking now, this slide has got the December year-to-date figures on, and I will share with you some of the results. The January results came out last night, so I'll share with you some of that where there were changes. But as of December and continuing into January, all the domestic routes that SAA flies to are profitable. Africa, our Africa routes are still the most profitable market for us, and we as SAA have grown faster than the market has grown, and I'll share some of that stats with you. If you take the Southern Africa traffic, has grown by 8%, while SAA traffic has grown by 13%. West Africa traffic has grown by 2%, while SAA traffic has grown by 11%. Central Africa traffic by 31%, and that is quite a big growth in the last year. And just for information, this is yet, it's a full year comparison year on year figure, so it's not a month to month figure. And SAA's volume, contrary to the Central Africa, has grown by 48%, which is quite significant. The North Africa traffic has grown by 17, and the SAA volume by 27. East Africa traffic grown by 4, while SAA passengers have grown by 5%. On the Africa market, all the Africa routes are profitable. There are two that are currently struggling, and those are leisure markets. and I will mention it at this stage. It is Mauritius and it is Big Four, and it's leisure market in the economic meltdown. You know, there is the traffic that takes the train first. There are obviously plans to turn that around, and the good news is though that the January, for the month of January, although the year to date will still be in the red, for the month of January, Mauritius as well as Big Four have also turned again a profit. So if we move on to the international network and we'll break it up by markets, the markets that SAA is quite strong in is the Australasia market as well as the South America market. And you can see in terms of the market growth, where overall it was experienced for 12% for Australasia, SAA grew by 19% in terms of, and then mainly at the expense of Emirates and Qantas. This is very much in alignment with our strong position of being in the Southern Hemisphere geographical location. Then South American traffic, also a strong point because of the Southern Hemisphere location as well as the connecting traffic that we can bring through. Although the traffic has decreased by 7%, and that's primarily because of the Malaysian Airlines that has pulled back quite a lot of capacity there, we have grown our volumes by 3%. So we've picked up quite a bit of that thing. Then when we move to Asia, or let me move back to the North American market. The North American market, we have decreased our passengers by 8%. And mostly because of our competitor Delta. The good news again, like I said, is on the international routes. I just want to mention here that for January, with the exception of the New York route, all our international routes were also in January profitable. The big reason for that was that we had a fuel price of $35 to $40, which helped us a lot. The profitability was very much impacted up to the end of December with a fuel price that went up to $147. And our long-haul flights are obviously the most impacted by the fuel price because of the distances. So that is a big factor into the profitability of the long-haul routes. And then the Asia market. The Asia market is a market that's very price-sensitive, and we are under strain there, specifically from the Asian carriers as well as the Middle Eastern carriers. And so you would see that we had a decline of 12% while that market has grown by 6%. And also then there was a lot of frequencies. The additional frequencies, especially from Emirates, have impacted. The additional frequencies from Emirates to South Africa has really impacted also on our passenger numbers. Then the last one is in terms of Europe, traffic from South Africa, and there's a gap there. There must be traffic from South Africa to Europe has declined by 2% overall, and then the passenger growth has declined in line with the grounding of our 747s. We took out more capacity of about 8% out of the routes. That's the 747 that was on the Paris market, and we've replaced it with the Airbus 200s on the London route. So it's very much that we will continue to move our capacity to the areas that's profitable, and we are doing that on a continuous basis. And it is true that under the circumstances, we are looking at combining capacity to see where it makes most sense to put our capacity. And currently, Africa is for us the growth market. And in the absence of any fleet acquisition, we are moving what we have to the most profitable, which will mean that we will combine maybe some off-peak times in domestic, for instance, to make these aircraft available for the expansion in Africa. So that is some of the market performance that I just wanted to share with you. On an operational level, there are definitely upward trends. Now, it's always good to say this is what I think about myself, but I think what we say is you need to have some objective views on this, and therefore I want to share with you some of the customer service results. The first one is customer surveys that we do every 6 months. impaired studies, and our customers have said that our service has improved to 77%, but so it's an increase with 7%, so there's an upward trend. We're not saying that that is the best that we can achieve. Obviously, we want to move over into the 90s, but what we're saying is that there is an upward trend. And primarily because also of the things that the customers have identified as very important to them, on-time performance, and because our on-time performance has increased dramatically, customer satisfaction has increased. The others are also network and schedule and connectivity, which obviously with our network changes have assisted people so that they have less time on the ground when they do connection flights. So that has definitely helped. We are not comfortable with the 77, but we're comfortable that it's moving up. So we are trying to move it even more. There is a formal program that we also have put in place to track and monitor this customer service. Then on the Star Alliance, the alliance we belong to, do a quarterly result in terms of customer satisfaction of all members of Star Alliance. And we are 78% there, which is in alignment also with our own customer service survey that we've done. Again, I said it's not the ideal. We are moving and we want to move upwards, but there is a trend. And then the last one is the SkyTrack results, the very recent result, where SAA's business class were ranked 11th and the economy class 14th globally. This is a global customer service survey of 167 airlines with more than 10 million respondents, and we're very proud that in especially the business class we have even won Emirates. So this is something that I think for a relatively small airline that was mentioned with limited resources, we're quite proud of the ranking. The goal is obviously for us to move in the top 10. So those are some of the operational things that I just want to share with you.
Great. Thank you, Vera. In summary then, Mr. Chair, SAA's operational performance is above target, and SAA will continue to drive all areas of operational performance, particularly in areas of customer satisfaction and in areas where we still have improvements to make, such as baggage handling. Restructuring has been successful, as Vera has shown us, and that has positioned us extremely well to meet challenges from an operational perspective. Our market share is growing, particularly in our focus areas, and SAA will in future, following the lead given by DPE, will in future drive into new markets that offer us potential. We will be launching Douala in Cameroon and Buenos Aires in Argentina shortly, which is an example of this. We will also exit markets that don't offer us profitability or offer very little potential of future profitability to us. And the key is in being fast in and out into the market and being very proactive. Customer satisfaction is on an upward trend. We will strive to maintain that, and that also is an all-encompassing approach. We need to put the product on the ground. We need to offer the connectivity. We need to make sure we price correctly, and we need to make sure our image is repaired. And all that goes to a position where I think SAA is still on track to make an operational profit by the year end. Having said that, the caveat, of course, is that the forecasted depth of the meltdown and the extent of the meltdown and time period, the duration of it, remains as we have projected. Should it be worse, that may have to be rethought, but at this stage we believe we are able to make an operational profit by the year end. Having said that, the bottom line will be a loss, unfortunately, and this is mainly due to the reduction in operational profit because of reduced revenues. And that's, of course, in line with the economic downturn that hit us in the last quarter of last year. We are paying interest on loans roughly to the tune of 300 million rand, which is something we had not actually forecasted for last year. As you know, a substantial portion of the last year, the third and fourth quarter of the last year, were burdened by a very high fuel price, at times peaking to $147 per barrel. It has come up, but we still labour under that burden from within our results for the year. And then finally, SAA will be experiencing hedge losses, because of fuel volatility. The fuel price has risen from around $70 up to $147 and then back down again to around $38 this morning. I'd just like to remind members that hedging is a function that is carried out to try and dampen the market movement, the effect of those market movements on the airline, which means that while hedging has the impact of chopping off the high peaks of the fuel price, those chopping off of the high peaks must be paid back from the valleys. And we're in a valley at the moment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all we will present.
Thank you very much, Are there any other inputs on SAA? And I suggest we do a round of questions. We've kept to the hour which was allowed for the presentation. Thank you very much. Ms. Chauhan?
Chairperson, mindful of time, because we do have those other presentations on Eskom and CBMR as well. I'll try and be very brief. I've got quite a few questions. Perhaps I should start with the issue of the 1.6 billion that has been approved this year. I'd like to know precisely what it is meant for, what is it earmarked for. And in the presentation, we've heard that SAA, and it's no surprise to this portfolio committee, of course, that SAA is undercapitalized. But we constantly hear that the department's going to approach Treasury to capitalize. And I think we must be very clear what we mean when we say capitalization as opposed to bailout, as the professor was saying. It's not a bailout, it's a capitalization because the business has to grow. You need new equipment, you need new planes, you need operational things that has to keep you in business if you're going to be an airline of any worth. So the question that I have is what is it that was asked for in terms of the capitalization amount required? And specifically, what are the reasons that Treasury has preferred for not granting this amount, assuming it's a higher amount than the 1.6 that was asked for? And certainly, what are the implications, particularly around 2010 and your preparations for that? The second question is, there seems to be, with the two inputs, one from the department and one from SAA, there seems to have been two separate targets for restructuring, because in the inputs by the department, there's clearly an indication that revenue management marketing market share haven't actually met the targets, whereas you just indicated the HR, perhaps there's clarity there. The issue with the drug smuggling, I think, is unfortunate, say the least, and I'm not sure, I guess you guys will know what that does to brand name SAA, and how you would, you know, value that impact. But as the flag carrier, clearly the reputation of SAA is tarnished, to say the least, and by implication the reputation of the country. And I just wanted to know, in terms of security measures, what you've undertaken to do, or have you implemented, and what other face saving market strategy have we got in place that you think needs to happen? Retention bonuses was a big contention in this committee a while ago. Where are we with that? Are we continuing with this particular plan? As you would know, we have expressed a great deal of concern about this issue, and depending on the answer, Chair, we may want to probe further on this matter, so perhaps we could just get an input on the retention bonuses. Lastly, Chair, I think that one of the biggest issues that SAA has at the moment is it is an image problem. We flog the horse. It's become the national flogging horse. And people seem to have the impression that SAA is a white elephant, and if it does go bottom up, there'll be little or no impact on the economy. And I just wanted to find out whether this accords with any of your thinking. I'm certainly sitting from this side of the house know a little better, but I don't think that many people quite appreciate the airline business, not just the business. It has a direct impact on the economy in a very material way, particularly in this province, for example, as far as tourism is concerned, etc. So the question that I have really is, can we as a country actually afford to be without an SAA? The impression is also created that if SAA does go bottom up, that you know we have a whole host of other airlines waiting to come and invest in the economy and so on. Now, Brazil has had a similar kind of experience because we placed in the southern hemisphere. I wonder if anybody has any sense of the impact of that airline going bust in that country and whether, in fact, there are hundreds of other airlines who are lining up to take its place. Thank you.
I guess that's right. Yes, I think there's been a number of questions asked, so let's get some answers to that, and then we'll take more questions after that.
Okay, we'll split it between ourselves and Andrew, you also going to answer, I imagine. The 1.6 billion is, at this current juncture, at least the letter of the law attached to what we use it for, or is to convert the 1.56 guarantee into cash equity that goes into business. So it doesn't have a net effect of increasing the equity available in the business. It keeps it the same, but its positive benefit is that it reduces our interest costs for the company. The amount of money that we had asked for was in the range of 5.2 billion rand. And as you recall in previous presentations that we've made to you, this was to deal with the Voyager liability, which is something that we have to deal with as a result of the international reporting standards that we have to deal with. The second was to deal with a provision, one way or the other, for the Airbus contract. I say one way or the other, taking delivery. If we don't, we run the risk of being sued as well. And then the last element had to do with just making sure that the reserves that were available in the company, the going concern issues, we had already had a 1.3 billion rand guarantee, the conversion of that guarantee into equity for the business. Effectively dealing with a word which I don't like using necessarily because I think that tends to be treated as an excuse, legacy cost. But if you are able to do that, you can then force management to go and run the company as everybody else would run the company because you would have dealt with the worst of the capitalization problems that face the airline. I'll just go to the last two and imagine because the company has to deal with the drug trafficking issues, the revenue management stuff and the retention bonuses. And I'll talk just in terms of we had actually commissioned a study and I was just checking about when we will get that. Unfortunately, with an end of the administration. But I suppose in the new administration, we'll come back and present on that, on what's happened to Brazil, to the Brazilian economy in totality, with VARC going down. And because one of the things that people forget to look at is the interlinkages that the airlines have into an economy, and especially when you own the airline in terms of how much of the revenue that arises from that industry stays in South Africa and how much of it goes out of South Africa. When you have a carrier which is not a South African carrier, the revenue doesn't stay in South Africa. It's only that which relates to the costs which are incurred in South Africa, which is the money that stays in South Africa. That would normally sort of like locate itself in another country. One of the things that we've been also trying to look at, and I'm hoping that by the time I stop speaking, we can have an answer on that, is to look at what's happened in this current environment where, because of the downturn, other carriers which are registered in other countries can look at South Africa, and South Africa is not a primary destination for them. For us, because it's a whole market, it becomes a primary destination. We'd look at South Africa and look at what's happening to the South African economy, what volumes are there in the South African economy, what's happened to the volume of trade between us and our major trading partners, who incidentally and unfortunately still remain not predominantly African, but rather European and the US, would look at what's happening to that level of business, and on the back of that, cut down their services to South Africa, which has unfortunately the effect of reducing capacity and basically keeps you locked off. And I think we've made this presentation before, that when you're an end hemisphere carrier and you have an economy the size of South Africa, it's extremely dangerous not to be able to control volumes of traffic for business purposes that come into the country. But I'll leave management to deal with other questions.
Thanks, I'll ask my executive colleagues. But just to add to what Alfred said about the South Africa, without SAA, we are board always had the understanding from our shell, the minister, that cabinet given us the instructions to operate as if South African Airways must be here and will be here. So we always had the impression that that the cabinet and the government was insistent upon SAA being in South Africa. So I think Portia has given those answers. Just can I pass over to you for the question, or the question about the implications for 2010? If we don't get things lined and recapitalized, and then the question about the structural targets seems to be a mismatch in what we're saying, that the drug smuggling issue. Well, and I just say about the retention bonuses, we have, as you'd have seen, instituted an external forensic investigation into a number of issues that have been raised, but this issue of retention bonuses mentioned in that, so we will deal with that as part of this investigation in our report. But just to say that the allegations have often been made that management paid themselves retention bonuses, which itself is not correct. The company in its restructuring, and there was an outcry about the way that we were losing expertise and skills. And the board asked the Remuneration Committee to develop policy and plans and a scheme around the retention. So whether one agrees with that or not, it is not as if the management illegally paid themselves retention bonuses. But we will report on that fully. There was an approved retention premium scheme. A number of persons and skills were identified to whom those were paid. But Chairperson, I say that is the moment part of that investigation, and we will report more fully on that when we complete that investigation. Okay, over to you, please.
Thank you, Professor, and thank you, Chair. I propose to deal with the drug smuggling first of all. As the chair ladies mentioned earlier on, there's no doubt that the damage to South African Airways image is horrendous. It's disastrous. And it has a fairly widespread ripple effect on SA's operations. Not only does it bring SA into disrepute, but it also raises concerns with foreign and local security agencies on SA's ability to run an unmonitored operation. This will no doubt bring in a huge amount of security scrutiny and high level of searches and disruptions to our operation. So it remains absolutely critical that we nip this in the bud immediately. One might ask why we didn't do it last time. We did, in fact, do what we could do last time. We strengthened the security around the specific areas that were left in that particular instance. In this case, the two staff members involved were in collusion. One was from the security company that we used to control our onboard boarding security for our cabin crew, and what happened there was she gave three tags that she did not record to the cabin crew member who used them to tag the bags that she had hidden away her drugs in, and those bags were able to get on board without being traceable. They were picked up at the other end, but of course nobody took ownership of them, and we weren't able to trace them. While these crew were sitting in jail in London, we were able to discover that the three tags that were that had been issued were in sequence, and that enabled us to track the security guard who issued them. And through that process, we were able to discover which cabin crew member was responsible. And by the time they arrived back, we pretty much had the case wrapped up. And this particular the response to that was to tighten up the control over bag tags primarily. Secondly, to institute for the first time for some time a random search process over Kevin Crewe leaving the Crewe Centre. I must reiterate that we have roughly 600 to 700 Kevin Crewe going through that security centre on a daily basis, and we have probably 4 or 5 security people there. So a full 100% search was just simply not practical without causing an enormous disruption to the services of SAA. And I think it's important to understand that it's a payoff between increased security and less efficient operations. And once you try and find that perfect balance, we didn't get that balance right this time. The current incident occurred through a different modus. The cabin crew this time used a carry-on bag and bypassed the baggage system. So we were not able to pick it up. Although we did have additional security, I think it's important to understand too that this drug smuggling plague that we're experiencing now is a movement of drugs, is a supply chain of drugs from the growing areas of Southeast Asia and South America into Africa, where Africa is used as a hub, as a transit point into Europe. And the point in Africa moves. When I was at Kenya Airways had an enormous problem with drug smuggling. When they tightened it up, it makes Kenya an area that is unattractive to the trade. And so they simply moved to another country. It's now SA's turn. And I say that because if you look in context, SAA has not had a drug problem since the 4 or 5 episodes it experienced in 2005 and 2006. At the time, increased security chased that problem away. And we will do that again this time. Some of the measures, obviously, I wouldn't want to go into too much detail because it would just present the opportunity for the drug smugglers to work around them. But they do include bringing in sophisticated equipment that can detect drugs, bearing in mind that the standard X-ray equipment cannot see drugs at all and is absolutely useless in tracking down drug smuggling. We have already implemented new equipment, or sort of introduced new equipment to detect drugs as from this morning. The second thing we did it immediately, we heard of it, is to form a task team between South African Airways and the South African Police Services and Access Security. We've also been joined in that task team by Customs, and Customs oversaw the entire departure operation last night. We've asked for help. SAA needs that help. It can't do this alone. It is really not SAA's sole responsibility to fight crime in this country. It is something that needs a collective effort of all players at the airport. Shall I take questions on that area now?
About impact on 2010.
Okay, now I'm just talking about reviewing questions on the drug smuggling first.
Are there any other questions on drug smuggling? Okay, no, let's move on.
Okay, could I ask my colleague Nombula Kabinda, who's general manager in charge of sales and marketing, to talk about South African Airways preparation for 2010. Nombula.
Thank you, Chris. The official airline for 2010 is currently Emirates. And our preparation are limited to a commercial agreement we are negotiating with them in terms of our participation. The big one for us is we've been able to get appointed as the tour operator, one of the 3 tour operators within the country to run up the domestic market. That we did through our South African Travel Center brand. The rest of the other capacity issues are being discussed with both FIFA and MET, and we will be getting into another commercial agreement that will ensure that we enable transportation of the lot of people that are coming around throughout the world. We are working with the tour operators, and we should be able to define our final booking strategy by end of the financial year. So there's a lot of activities that are coming through in terms of promotion. But that will start beginning of April. Okay.
Thank you.
The other 2 questions were one which has been answered by TG. But also to add one additional advantage of having a national airline is that under the current airline structure or aviation structure, countries are regulated under what we call bilateral services, air services agreement, which regulate the number of flights conducted between countries. And they're really designed to make sure that each country has an equal shot at traffic between those 2 countries. And normally mean that, for example, if between here and Nigeria, there's a certain number of frequencies allocated to each country, each country's airline. If you don't have an airline that can operate those frequencies, then you are exposed to a lack of competition in that only one airline can fly, and that is the airline of the other country. And that automatically and always ends up in a lack of competition, which results in much, much higher pricing. And I've seen that. I've worked in various African countries, and I've seen that African countries that don't have airlines pay enormously high prices for traffic. That is one of the big issues that we face. The other question I think was asked was, how is SAA going to deal with this image problem? And I'm going to ask Nomvula, who owns that particular part of the business, to answer that.
We are aware that a whole lot of the publications that have been out in the press have had a really great dent on the image. And there are two issues to that. One, if you had looked at what they are, they seem to be person-specific, which they were specific to a person, and the rest of them were specific to SAA. But those that are relating to SAA were purely the public expressing a lack of confidence in SAA or in SAA's management of the business. We are putting together a program which has already started, where we're going back to the public to start talking about what we are doing in the business or what our value is, our value proposition is. The first of those campaigns broke now currently. It's our 75th anniversary this February. We have a full promotion, more like an image promotion, that talks about the memories that people have on SAA and the milestones that we've created in people's lives, and we're going out to thank them for the support they've given us. What we're hoping to get is to get people to realize that the challenges that are facing us are purely, as I say, might be person-specific, but we are looking at the challenges that are customer-specific, and that we're addressing through our Journey of the Champion program. It's very difficult to somehow take those perceptions out in the market, except through the investigation and through anything that might happen in the future, we might be able to establish the truth thereof and be able to publicize it. But with regard to the image and the confidence of SAA within the customer, it is only within our hands to try and resell the brand and the value proposition thereof within the long term. Unfortunately, it is one of those incidences that, like all of us, we wake up in the morning and we find the news up here. Our response to it has been very limited because of the investigations that the chairman has been talking about. And it's very difficult for us to react on it. And all we can do is focus on the business and focus on what we can control, which is just making travel a pleasure for our customers.
Thank you. TJ?
I just wanted to go, I think a degree of frankness is also quite useful. I mean, I think there are different pieces of the reputation which we've earned, and we should own that, as both between the shareholder and the carrier itself. It's not just that we've been paying to them hard, because we are victims, we are innocent in the process. I do think that's important that we own that. The other point, and it's partly also, I think it's important though, that for the committee to acknowledge the fact that SAA operates in a competitive environment. And in a competitive environment, competitors are going to do everything to make sure that whatever is negative that can be said about SAA is going to be said. Let's also be frank. Comair, Kulula, One Time, or any of our local domestic competitors in South Africa don't have to go through this exercise where they publicly will have to reflect on what they're doing, what their commercial strategies and the rest and the like. It's something that a state-owned enterprise. Now, I'm not getting into the philosophical of why does the state own, we don't own this airline, and we have a responsibility to ensure that the airline is run in a commercially sustainable basis. And that, for me, is a fair attack when we get attacked on that point. It is therefore, though, that we believe that if you capitalize the enterprise properly, and if you capitalize it properly, then you can stand back and demand that the enterprise itself operates in a commercially sustainable fashion. there are a number of things that we have to change. We have the installed base in maintenance, technical services and maintenance in SA, funded sure by all of us in South Africa at the end of the day. We have to ensure, because one of the arguments that we would make as a DPE from a government perspective, the ownership of SAA Technical is not just to the interest of SAA, but it has to be a service that's competitively available to everyone. Hence, one of the elements of the strategy for SAA going forward is to make sure that those operations which have to be converted into profit centers on their own, there's an arm-length relationship between SAA Technical and SAA, so that in effect, when it offers services to SAA, it offers services to SAA in a similar fashion that it would be offering services to any other carrier that operates in the domestic market. SAA has a reputation of being predatory. It's been in some of their slides, and you saw it in Africa. They are predatory, and maybe there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe there's something wrong with that. But I suppose we should then get to the point as well that if properly funded, that predatory status of it can be effectively defended by the enterprise. There is, however, a need to move culturally in the way that the enterprise operates to much more of a greater partnership sense. When we go into the continent, the sense mustn't be that we must be the winners to take it all at every single point. It is often a source of some degree of discomfort that when you look at our profitability, it's highest on the continent, because we leverage exactly the point that Chris makes, is that on the continent, there tends to be a greater sense of inflexibility about bilaterals. So you find yourself having in a country where there's virtually no other operator, and we're the only operator who gets the frequency, so we make the money. That's not entirely right, because we wouldn't find that acceptable in South Africa. So there are certain significant changes that we have to make in our operations. But I think if we did move towards an airline that was properly capitalized and that you were able to have a sense that it was there, it operated like every other enterprise, and I think being mindful of the fact that we are competing. Whoever, it's the telecom situation. You can say whatever you want to say about whether it's inefficient or not. By virtue of the fact that there is a Vodacom, there is an MTN and other players in that industry, they're going to watch telecom like a hawk to make sure that they are able to make profits in the end. So I do think that there's a great deal of need for us to own what is our problem, make sure that other than us reflecting what other people say, that we can with honesty look at ourselves and look at the carrier and know that we are running an excellent company on the one hand, but also I think there needs to be a greater sense of mind on what is the game.
Thank you, DG. Just before I ask for some more questions, just a comment from my side and one or two questions. You talk about the image of SAA, and a lot of times it's not things that cost a lot of money to address. It's more little thing like you get off the plane in Johannesburg, the little TV screen is not up telling you which carrier to go to your luggage. And there are no SAA people around to assist you or tell you which carrier to go to. And if you do find anybody and ask them, they say, no, it's not our responsibility, that's access. And your dealing is not with access, you're dealing is with SAA. Also, I mean, I believe you got rid of a lot of good staff. My own experience in Port Elizabeth, you got a lot of good staff you got rid of. People who went out of their way to help their customers, including when you had a strike. While the CEO was on holiday, they were running around satisfying customers. I don't know if it's part of your cost cutting, but I find lately when I fly on SAA, it's almost as if the staff has been trained to avoid eye contact so that you don't ask for something extra. And maybe you should look at it as a small thing. It's not big things that cost lots of money. But let me not go on about that. SAA Technical Services, you say it should be run as a DG at an arm's length. How many members are on that board now? Are they independent trustees or are they trustees that board members have come from SAA? With regard to the retention bonuses, Professor, this committee continuously raised the issue of the high turnover of your senior staff at SAA. And the CEO's reaction every year was, well, you know, these people are in demand, and they go and they get better offers and they leave. This is the standard answer we used to get from the CEO. We used to ask about exit interviews. We never got any feedback on that. A lot of us get anecdotal evidence that, you know, a lot of people had problems with the management style of the CEO, and that is why they left. But we've never been able to get a proper answer from SA or for the reasons on this high turnover. The other thing is Seabreeze, when they did their restructuring plan, did they comment on the management style of SAA? Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Mr. Cotto, Mr. Wong? Mr. Kekana? Let's start with Mr. Kekana.
My name is David Kekana. I'm actually from DMP, Department of Mineral and Energy. But just on this SAA, because we use it a lot, I also want to endorse, in fact, the theme of the group of questions that was asked earlier. The image is important. Today on Radio 7, SAFM, special reporter was discussing SAA and the theme of drugs. I mean, the point is this. It doesn't come out very clear as to whether you're running at a loss or you still being paid, or there's hope that even if you are running at a loss, in a few years it will be turned around. I'm saying this because this thing of small things, I mean, my impression at times is just the inefficiency that is there. Take, for example, the gold card, the Voyager card. I mean, a lot of members of parliament ultimately opted for being. Because this year we are given a gold card, next year we are told we've got to start afresh. And we can't use the launch. In my case, I can't use the launch because I'm no more on gold card. And if you compare that to our competitor, BA, BA gives us gold card every year, for as long as they are a member of parliament. Now, we lose a whole guaranteed revenue from members of parliament just because one year comes, the other year you deprive them of their gold card. This is what we've been experiencing with SAA. And ultimately for us, that is inefficient. You know, we are loyal, we want to pay allegiance to what we know is part of South Africa. But if the operational part of it is unreasonable, I mean, and we just deprive gold card and BA gives us gold card, we are forced by circumstances to go to BA. So this seems like those could actually be losing SAA a lot of revenue simply because you are told at the launch this is the rule and you don't have a gold card anymore and you've got to be sent away. And you ask yourself, why should people be taking this type of decision that ultimately doesn't benefit the country, even from us who are so loyal to this country? Now, the big question is, do you think you are still running, that didn't come out clear, are you at a loss? Are you being bailed by government, or are you, there's hope that one day you can run cross-check and still provide a good service?
Let's take Mr. Cotwell and Mr. Brown.
Thank you. My question was more a suggestion than a question regards to the baggage theft. My experience of flying with SAA is whenever you check in your bag, there's somebody who goes into the airport. And SAA always answers by saying, you know, it's not our responsibility. Once you check in, it's somebody else's responsibility. Did you ever consider of investigating or stealing the checked-in luggage? It will maybe save you, I mean. The other one is with regards to on-site entertainment. Did you ever consider, in conjunction with the Department of Tourism, the hotels, the car hire companies, in coming up with a video maybe, you know, for the long-haul flight information on South Africa, say when people come into the country, these are the hotels on offer, these are the 9 different provinces, this is what South Africa is about. And then on maybe the Johannesburg Cape Town site, a small video on the Western Cape, say, look, when you come to Cape Town, I mean, I fly often and I meet up with the local tourists, international tourists, wanting to know what is there to do in Cape Town. So SAA maybe come up with some kind of video saying, say, in Cape Town, we've got the waterfront, we've got House Bay, we've got these hotels to offer. And maybe you can make some money out of the advertising space from the hotels and the car rental companies.
Chairperson. One question on clarification on your hedging losses. Can we just understand a bit more at what scale you're looking at, and what was the hedging on? Was it hedging on fuel prices? Was it hedging on dollar prices? And on the currency, I meant. And is it correct, from my understanding, that this is the second time SAA suffered a big major hedging loss in the past 5 years? Because my understanding was, but in 2-3 years back, to hedging on dollar currency, and we also suffered major major hedging loss. And what was the policy on that regard after that particular loss? And is it a standard practice for other airlines or in the industry to hedge whatever that you just hedged? So that's one question. Another thing is, I think on the customer, we heard earlier that every 6 months there's a customer satisfaction survey that was done. I think that's a surprise. The first time we hear it in this committee, because if you got asked, the acting chair and chairperson in the past, at least 3-4 years, we've been asking the CEO for exactly what that is. And there was never a positive response. So I'd like to know exactly how did the customer's satisfaction survey done? Was it done actively, or was it done randomly by telephone? Or because I can tell, I mean, after the past 5 years, obviously all the members here travel a lot on SAA. As far as I know, not one member has been asked for customer service, certainly not myself. Thanks.
Did you want to start with Professor, yourself?
Yes, I think many of those questions are probably operational things, and to ask them. Let me just say about this customer satisfaction. I mean, I've almost ruled in our board meetings, asked board members, don't use my board meeting as a complaint session. Because, I mean, we also have this current question, are our experience anecdotal, and how does it match up with the measurements that management does? I mean, I'm sure Chris will respond to that. Chaplin, your own question is just about the retention of staff. And there had been a great turnover of staff. There had been developments in the industry internationally, and we had really started losing staff. The whole retention, as I will explain and report to you fully on the retention, but it's exactly that brought the board to the question of what are the various retention strategies. Because particularly in technical and some other areas, we were losing, and Chris can speak about technical particularly, we were losing staff and had to find ways to do that. About management style, you asked whether Seabury commented on that. I haven't read the Seabury thing very recently, but I don't think it was in their remit to comment on that. I think the other questions are very operational, and just one question was asked in the first round by the chairperson is, why Treasury has refused the recapitalization request. I would certainly also like to hear the answer to that, and perhaps that's a question that we should, through Parliament or through this committee, put because I think we're making the argument, I hope, persuasively by ourselves and the shareholder for the need for that recapitalization. So, Chairperson, can I hand over to Chris and his colleagues for the various question.
Thank you, Professor. Just going through the questions, let me handle the ones I can do first. The first one is did we ever consider the policy of ceding luggage? We did at one stage use independent people to bubble wrap luggage. It was successful at first, but it didn't take long for those in the baggage area who were perpetuating this kind of pilferage to get knives and they cut straight through. So it wasn't that effective. It is still available. It does add costs, but we believe it's something that should be a choice, and passengers can choose to do that. I think the answer more is in security measures at the within the sortation area. And I know that ACSA are focusing on this intensely, not only because it's a problem within South Africa and it seemed to be a problem within South African airports, but I think it could also be very damaging to South Africa's World Cup 2010 efforts. And there's very definitely a strong focus amongst all players. There is a tendency for my staff to try and deflect the blame. I understand that both from the chair and from various members. is absolutely true. They do try and deflect the blame towards other role players at the airport. It's not certainly not management's intention to do that. We work as a team with them, and we work in close consultation with them, and together we take responsibility for it. The second area is using advertising space. I'm going to ask my colleague, Nomboro Kabeni, to answer why we don't, or we haven't as yet, offered onboard advertising in things like food and on seats and so on.
It's work in progress. We are working with the Southern Tournament and putting together a video with a whole lot of promotional activities. And I know that it is belated, but it will definitely have reached into various aircraft domestically first from about, I think, April. But you'll notice that there is a campaign now on the 75th, and it will go through, and you have a whole lot of various route promotions, and they'll be coming up on the screens as well.
We do have advertising and or more so advertising promotional material on the in-flight entertainment system, and we do certainly have advertising within the in-flight magazine, but we haven't gone as yet as far as some airlines, for example, like One Time, they even advertise on the outside of the aircraft, like buses. Somewhere in between the two is the answer. Nomboro, could you talk about incorporating car hire and hotel accommodation packages as part of the South African Airways offering?
Yeah, the official strategy is around and more like giving much more of a value proposition to the Southern Travel Center, because we're only responsible for the seat availability. If you want to touch on the other markets, you need to sell a full service, and we can only do that via Southern Travel Center. We will be relooking at the franchise model. It's currently with the Competition Commission. To clear a whole lot of issues, but we'll be using that in the future to increase our reach to South Africa. South African Travel Center has got currently about 80 franchises, and they will be enforced or given much more value proposition to act as a mini SAA. But they will sell over and above what we do, full accommodation, your car, and the full travel package. And because, as I mentioned before, that they have been enforced by the appointment as one of the only three tour operators during 2010, that value proposition will be greatly used within our market for greater profitability.
Mr. Buller, to address the questions, could I ask my colleague, the CFO, who looks after the Voyager area, to discuss the Voyager question, which was why we always reverse gold cards at the end of each year and not be in states, and while Comair doesn't do that.
Thank you. The Voyager program is effectively a loyalty program which both ourselves and BA also have a program similar to that. In terms of that program, it's effectively meant to try and keep the customer loyal to the airline that is there and fly that airline on a regular basis. If you achieve a certain amount of flights that you do with that airline, you then get your status reinstated. If you don't fly during that period, which is a full-year cycle, then effectively you use that status. So from a BA perspective also, you don't get the same card or status if you basically don't continue to fly with it. So it's not an automatic renewal that you will get a gold card, unless you fly with the airline on a number of particular flights, a number of particular miles that you achieve, then you will retain that status. So in terms of that, if you continue to fly with us, I'm sure we will be able to give you a gold card again.
Except for when you cancel your flight to Port Elizabeth. And then we have to fly with, the SA Express, and then you punish your Voyager members.
Noted, Chair.
Chair, we'll take those suggestions into consideration and discuss it as a management team and come back to the Parliament with the response on it. To the Portfolio Committee with response on that. Question that was asked was, is SAA profitable? And us accountants, or some of ex-accountants, can answer this question for 2 hours and still not really make any sense, so I'll try and keep it as simple as possible. At an operational level, when I say operational, Your revenue is dispersed in two fashions. One is to pay for your operational costs that are incurred in generating that revenue. And the other is to pay for the cost of funding the assets and the working capital of the airline. Now, as my colleague in DPE, Dr. Shaw, has said, we are suboptimally funded, which means that we are required to pay for a lot more in interest to fund a much higher percentage of our total funding needs in the form of loans than most airlines would. A number of other airlines, as you saw in one of your slides, have a much higher capital base, which is not funded via interest. So the interest burdens in those airlines is far lower. So to try and simplify that, at an operational level, in other words, after we have dispersed those funds to pay for the costs of generating those funds, we are profitable and we expect to be profitable at the end of this year, and we expect to be profitable going into the future. The problem exists in after we've dispersed those funds for paying for operational expenses. The problem exists in paying for the cost of funding the airline. And that is where we are so far not profitable. And the second area which my colleague will address is, in this particular year, we did have challenges when it came to hedging. And I'd like to hand over to him to answer the hedging question. Thank you.
Clarity on what was said. Do we understand you correctly that the 300 million odd that you're paying in interest, were it not for that, you would show a profit on your balance, on your income expense?
What I'm saying is that were it not for that and the hedging losses, we would have shown the profit.
Check, and I just add to that. Effectively, what we're effectively saying is that in terms of the capital structure that you have and the recapitalization, this company is borrowed to the extent of 110%, which it means that basically you're paying not only the 300 million, but you're also paying on other interest, which is effectively to your lessors, the people that you buy your planes from. And hence, your interest burden, besides the 300 million, which is the guarantee that is provided, your interest burden as a whole is so big that it wipes out all your operational profits that you have. I'm sure you run your businesses as normal. You wouldn't want it to be running at 110% on borrowed money. No business really survives in the long term if it's all the time on borrowed money. It has to have a certain amount of capital. And that capital was wiped out when the hedge book loss happened 4 or 5 years ago. Since then, the company has been living on 110% debt. If you run on 110% debt, you will never survive on the long term. And hence, it's important that you get the company. And that's why I say that the current management is living with the legacies of the past, paying off the debt that is there since 2004. And henceforth, it is that interest burden that takes it into a loss. Now, with regards to the question that was mentioned earlier on with the hedging situation, the industry, it's like insurance. If you don't take out insurance and you have a big accident, you're going to lose all the money. What type of insurance do you have? You could have fully comprehensive insurance, or you could have third-party insurance. If you have fully comprehensive insurance, then you know you're protected in terms of that. Hedging, and your question was, does the industry apply hedging policies? Well, let's put it this way. When the last hedge debacle happened, at that time, the Treasury, the DPE, and the management set up a policy which effectively managed the hedge positions going forward. And with that, it is a very conservative policy. I'll give you an indication of what the policy internationally is, because that's what you asked in terms of establishing whether the policy is in line with international benchmarks. We're saying we're much more conservative. And we actually, with regards to the time that we've been through, where fuel went to $147 and came down back to $40, we've had the perfect storm in this past year. For the past 100 years, I don't think we've ever had a situation within a period of 1 year where fuel has gone up to $147 and come down to $40. Or, in percentage-wise, we've never gone that way. IATA, who provides the statistics, have indicated that the world market, in terms of their tendencies to hedge, they hedge their book up to 80%. We've hedged up to 40%. Our policy says 40 to 60%. We've gone on the lower limit. Airlines have gone up to 80%. If you take, for instance, Cathay Pacific, they have incurred a $16 billion hedge loss. $16 billion. Okay? Comparing that, so as I said, we're at 40%, whereas the international benchmark is 80%. International benchmark is also saying that you should hedge 4 years out. So if you hedge at a four-year-out situation, the IATA results also reflect that it's sitting at $110 for the international benchmark. Where are we with regards to our hedging? Our hedging is 12 months out. What is the impact in terms of the loss? I can't give you that figure now because basically the accounting standards require to benchmark at the 31st of March when the hedge book rolls out in terms of a 12-month rollout. So again, compared to the world at large, we're a drop in the ocean. And in terms of the losses that could possibly arise, again, as I said, at 31st of March, if the fuel price sits at $130 again, nobody will be making a loss, including the international airlines. And from that perspective, the policy is set up to manage your risk between a certain level, a top level and a bottom level, as the CEO has indicated. And in terms of managing that top level or bottom level, we are within that level and managing it. And within that level, you're going to have profits and losses coming through. Last year, we had a profit of $300 million. This year, we may have a different situation. It all depends on when you cut off at the 31st of March.
I think also just to add to that, one of your questions was what the situation as far as foreign exchange hedging was concerned. To some degree, the losses incurred in fuel hedging were offset by profits on foreign exchange hedging. I think the last question I have recorded, Chair, is to talk more about the six-month customer surveys. In fact, I'm quite surprised that this forum has not heard of the email surveys, because in fact there are three forms of surveys. We do an internal survey every 6 months, but internal is always questionable, even though it's done by people who are given full independence within the airline. We are also surveyed by Skytrax, which is an independent airline body out of the UK. And Skytrax have, I think, rated us the best airline in Africa for 7 years in a row. And we are also surveyed by the Star Alliance, Central Star Alliance management team. Now, SAA forms part of an alliance of, I think, 13 airlines. And we are surveyed by them, and we have a positioning there. I'll ask Vera to talk a bit more about that.
Thank you, sir.
Just briefly on that.
I'll be very brief. Just in terms of the customer survey internally, we do not give it out as a comprehensive methodology. So I just want to put that up front. We use it as a dipstick so that we can compare it also with the external survey. What we do is the 6 months, every February and every September, so that we can see in terms of if there's changes in behavior in the 6 months. It's usually about 5,000 surveys. It's on flight at point of service delivery, so when you experience the service at that stage, and it's a blind study because we usually say we pick the flights without people knowing the flights, as well as the seat numbers. So a survey gets allocated to a specific seat number. So that's how it's done from a methodology point of view.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I think we're going to have to move off SAA now. We've got two more presentations. If there's anything else you want to say on SAA, DJ? It was my question about the SAA technical, but we can talk about it afterwards. Unless you have the answer, sure.
So obviously, one of the things that we said, the Prof asked an interesting question, and I shall not get into politics, which the Chair had asked, and I assume the House will take up the Prof's suggestion, because the rules of engagement on the budget is that we don't get told why you didn't get the money. That's one. But then, because we haven't gotten the money, a move is definitely being in the underlying operation to look for partners. And so we are doing a governance review. So at present, it is much more of a subsidiary board than it's anything else. But going forward, you'd want to treat it as a board, as an associate, as opposed to a subsidiary. But I think we're ready for that. Chair, I just couldn't resist it. The point that the CFO was saying, the hedges, which effectively are derivatives, in the end, when you look at them,
is a problem that we have to deal with in electricity going forward. Chris is going to not necessarily talk about that, but it's one of the issues that we have to make sure gets removed from ESCOM's balance sheet. And this is something that's a historical that we still have, which affects the earnings of most of these of SOEs. You would be aware that Transnet dealt with theirs and have removed and have virtually moved quite vanilla contracts with all of their customers. We need to move to that because it has the effect of causing quite major upswings and downswings depending on what's happening through commodity prices. Same thing is going to be happening to ESCOM in this financial year.
Thank you very much. Prof, do you have any last words?
No, just again to thank you. I think this was very useful to have this engagement at that end of time. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you to Professor Hebel, Mr. Snipes, and the team from SAA. Thank you very much for your input. I think you would want to be excused at this stage. While we allow SAA to leave and the chairperson to resume his seat up here, we'll have a 5-minute break. Thank you.
Please, next time, keep up because we are running out of time. We've taken a fair share of time dealing with SAA, but I think it was worthwhile. But over to you, Gigi, and your team.
Thank you, Chair. Chris will leave because we do, fortunately, the two presentations, so we'll do them in the session.
Thanks, Chair and honourable members. Going to click the screens. Essentially, this slide gives you a rundown of what we want to brief you on today. It's a bit about the multi-year price determination, something about the government guarantees, the loan from government, then just a bit about the CAPEX program and the bill program, essentially, in terms of current status. Now, the multi-year price determination is what NERSA calls their process for determining ESCOM's revenue allocations or the annual revenue allocations in 3-year tranches. So the first set of 3-year price approval essentially started on the 1st of April 2006 and comes to an end on the 31st of March this year, which means that ESCOM must actually now apply for the next 3 years' worth of annual revenue allocation, which is dubbed MYPD2. The current regulatory model makes provision for ESCOM to recover the cost of production, which is essentially its operational expenses, including things like manpower, primary energy, which is coal, water, and diesel. Oh, sorry, too loud. And the cost of debt. And then they also get depreciation, and they get a return on their assets as part of that. What's important to note with the MYPD is that the model does not, while it assumes that you have access to equity or borrowing to fund your capital expenditure, it makes no provision for capital cash flow in the actual model, the regulatory model. One of the other issues that we have is that the current model values ESCOM's assets on an indexed historic cost basis, which actually started in 2006, and a lot of their assets are quite a lot older than just 2 or 3 years. Now, it's preferable, and the recently approved electricity pricing policy also states that it's preferable that a modern equivalent assets type of valuation is used. And also, one of the things is, I think the indexation on the model currently uses a CPI or CPIX or one of those indexes, which is not really indicative of capital cost inflation, which we know has been a lot higher over the last few years. In addition, given that capital expenditure funding is not included in the model, it's quite relevant that the current global financial market conditions have resulted in limited access to debt financing. And then also, ESCOM credit rating was downgraded by Moody's ratings agency last year, and that also further reduced its access to debt from the capital markets. Fortunately, the other ratings agencies had put ESCOM on a negative watch, but adopted a wait-and-see approach and had not downgraded them. Now, if we look at what has happened from the government side, last week, I think, the Minister of Finance in his budget speech announced some government guarantees to support ESCOM's borrowing program. And what that entailed essentially is almost 176 billion rand in guarantees on existing and new debt over 5 years. 25.97 billion of that is existing debt guarantees. Now, the reason for it, and it's not all of ESCOM's existing debt, What has been done is guarantees will be given for those portions of Eskom's existing debt where there would be a risk that investors would swap out the debt that they hold for guaranteed debt. And then the rest is of 150 billion of guaranteed debt to be allocated over the next 5 years, depending on Eskom's needs, but there will be an annual limit set in terms of the amount of debt that they could raise. If you wanted to take a straight line approach, you could say it's about 30 billion a year over the next 5 years. Now, government would either repay the debt in its entirety, that's the guarantee, or step into the shoes of Eskom and continue to make payments on Eskom's behalf. What we must note, though, is that guarantee fees are payable to the fiscus on guarantees issued. And this increases the operating cost because that's recovered through the tariff. So that does come through the tariff, and it does place upward pressure on the tariff or revenue allocation required. In terms of the subordinated loans that government has also approved in the previous budget speech for Eskom, 60 billion rand in total. It's a subordinated loan of which the terms and conditions are considered to be equity or quasi-equity by the ratings agencies. And the Special Appropriation Act did provide that Eskom would be provided with 10 billion rand in the current financial year, 30 billion rand next year, and then 20 billion rand in the year after. And government's rights subordinated to those of all other unguaranteed and commercial creditors. Now, that's to do with the market price determination and also essentially what government has done in terms of guarantees and loans. Just to talk a bit about Eskom's capital expenditure, the five-year plan from this year for the next 5 years, the 8-9 financial year to the next 5 years, is sitting at 385 billion rand. Now, in the three-year period that NERSA would be considering for the market price determination, there's a capital expenditure plan of about almost 274 billion rand. And the spend is apportioned roughly 72% to generation capacity, 14% to transmission, 9% to distribution, and then corporate 5%. And corporate includes projects such as the underground coal gasification, etc., that is coming to deal with. I think it's also important to remember that we always talk about these big power plants that Eskom is busy building, but with every power plant, you also have to build transmission lines to connect them to the grid, and there is expenditure that you have to incur there. I just thought I'd give you a quick rundown of the big generation build programs. They can be categorized into four categories, essentially. The return to service stations, which are essentially those stations which Eskom mothballed many years ago, and they are bringing back into service. There's three of them, Camden, Khutla, and Kumasi, and I've got a table that will show you the status of that a bit later. Open cycle gas turbines, which are gas plants which are fired by diesel, very expensive to run, but quick to put up and relatively cheap in terms of capital cost, but then the running cost is very high. There were the two stations, the one here in the Western Cape, Ankerlich, and then also Gariko, and then they've also done an extension to those, which I have in the table. Pump storage, which is essentially man-made hydro, and then the two really big coal-fired baseload power stations, which you call six packs because they comprise of six units each, Madupi and Kusile. This I thought would maybe interest the members. Really, this is the year-on-year net energy sent out. The global decline and the downturn of commodities and all that, how has it actually affected consumption? And this is energy. It's not the demand in terms of peak. This is the sales, essentially, if you want to call it. Now, if you look at it year on year, which is essentially from January to now, it's not a very long period, but the blue line is essentially the current year and the green is last year. If you take the average, it's about 7% down from last year in terms of sales. This is Eskom. This is our national grid figures. And if you take it for the financial year, so if you take year-on-year financial year, it's about 3%. So you could expect that by the end of the financial year, the decline in sales from year to year would have been somewhere around 2.5% to 3%. And if you look at that first week of the year, I think it must have been about 20% down. I don't know if people took longer holidays or what happened this year, but it was a massive decrease. Just remember the scale, though, doesn't start at naught, so it is magnified. One of the things to remember, though, is NERSA gives ESCOM a revenue allocation based on a certain amount of sales. So if they sell less than what was expected, effectively they will under-recover. And according to the rules, they should be allowed to claw that back in the next period. So in other words, whatever revenue they would have needed to run their operations, they should actually get the money that they didn't get in this period also, because they would have actually had to take that out of their bottom line, or essentially equity. So that's why we always talk about, when you talk the price, it is dependent on the volume. But I think what you're saying is you're looking at for the financial year, probably about 2, maybe 2.5% below forecast, essentially. And then this is really the last slide. It's just to look at the committed projects. This is the 385 billion rand capital expenditure program. And the little green blocks that are shaded essentially are the megawatts that have been delivered to the system since 2004. It's almost 3,000 megawatts of new generation capacity. And I think I can hear the thought. So if your sales have declined a bit, why do you need to continue with this plant? If you look at that, the column, that the second column from the left that says available capacity, at the 39,000 megawatt level, we're actually sitting with probably a 5% reserve margin. And we need 15 to 19% to have a stable system. So if you take another 10% on that, that's almost 4,000 megawatts of capacity that you just need to build to be able to get to the reserve margin. So if you go down, we're actually talking, if we have absolutely no growth going forward, probably by 2013-14 we would achieve that with the big Madupi coming online and some of Kutsele, but we're going to have some growth. I mean, I'm not a doomsayer, so in the next few years there will be some growth. And if we don't build those power stations, you can imagine in 4 or 5 years' time, if we have an upturn again, or 3 years, and we haven't put these plants into place, then we will be back where we were January last year. So the stuff that's on this table is what really has to happen as a minimum. There is actually a bit more build that should happen, but then, you know, that would take us into a much more, I suppose, a secure supply situation in the medium to long term. But in the short term, none of these particular projects can be moved out. What the decline in terms of growth has done is that one of the pump storage projects, it's called Tubatsu, was moved out of the window because that's a longer-term project that was going to come in later. But for the short-term stuff, we have to replenish our reserve, otherwise we're fighting a losing battle. And that's the end of the ESCOM. Should I continue? Okay, the briefing on the pebble bed modular reactor. Essentially, in terms of content, just going to run through a bit. I just want to look at what was the original offering. Now, what are the challenges that face to that? So I think we all know there are quite a lot of challenges. The current environment, the world keeps changing and changing faster and faster as we go. Just looking at some of the process heat stuff, as you know, the original was electricity only. A revised approach, considerations for that, and then also some value that's already been generated, and what is the way forward. Now, in terms of the original offering, it was envisaged that by PWMR that, you know, its high-temperature gas-cooled reactor could be utilized in a number of applications, and the markets that they're looking at were electricity generation, industrial process heat, desalination, and cogeneration. The intention is to design and build a high-temperature reactor with a closed-cycle gas-turbine power conversion system. And then some of the activities and objectives that were being pursued were to design, license, construct, and commission a demonstration power plant at Coburg with ESCOM as the client, to design, license, and construct and commission the pilot fuel plant at Pelindaba with Nexa, and then also to develop the process heat market. But that wasn't really the main focus. Now, the challenges with this original offering was that to think of ESCOM as the anchor customer for the demonstration power plant and the customer for the first 24 units in the current situation is not viable in the short to medium term, because it's got this massive bulk program and its own balance sheet is under severe pressure. There also was, or is, inherently higher risks of levels of risk which are associated with delivering this first-of-a-kind project and also the licensing challenges. constructing a demonstration power plant based on a closed cycle gas turbine conversion system for power, the Brayton cycle, involves a significant amount of first-of-a-kind engineering contributing to the risk. And then, because of that type of stuff, the Brayton cycle type things, this project contains research elements, and then other parts are known technologies. So the result you have is that elements of the project that really should be considered research and funded in that way are treated as part of a commercial product offering. So you have this mixture that really didn't sit well. Now, the current environment is, there is evidence that for PBMR, the market for process heat is significant, rather than just purely the electricity side. They have that interest been expressed by a number of parties, including the next generation nuclear plant program from the US and the oil sand industry in Canada, for a plant that's capable of producing both steam and electricity, not just one or the other, to start with. And you know, Eskom may still be a customer for the electricity PBMR, but the condition would have to be that it's got to be significantly de-risked. It should really use known technology. And if you adopt the standard nuclear island approach, you could use a lot more known technology because you don't have this integrated closed cycle. So the advantage of the standard nuclear island would be, and especially if you use it for process heat initially, is the advantage that it could be usable for the Brayton cycle or closed cycle eventually with some development. But you have the benefit of immediately enabling steam and electricity generation on known technologies. But the drawback is that you have a slightly lower temperature reactor than the original one, which means some applications are not available to you that you could have used it for. But you still benefit from a higher temperature reactor than any of the other conventional reactors in the market. So to sum up, this standard nuclear island or SNI approach de-risks the project and has the effect of reducing costs in that way. And also the Chinese are pursuing this direction as well. As you know, in terms of time to market, they're pretty much PBMR's competitor. Now, this is just a slide about the applications for process heat. There's quite a number of areas: steam generation, methane reforming, water splitting, and desalination. And if you look at this type of thing, it just seems there are many more opportunities in this area than purely power generation for a pebble bed type product. Now, the revised approach, what are we talking about is to look at the development of a product to service both electricity and process heat markets, to modify the demonstration power plant design to allow for this, where you can either do electricity or process heat, and de-risk the project by utilizing a standard nuclear island and that reduces technology and licensing risk because you don't have a first-of-a-kind project anymore. And then to explore additional potential customers in the process heat market, such as the Canadian oil sands companies, Sasol locally, and also this U.S. next generation nuclear plant program. And then to revise the business model to look at it from a sustainable commercial enterprise point of view rather than a funded research project. And as I said, the current one seems to be a bit of a mix. This is just some of the considerations for this revised approach. Safety is always paramount. The ability to license is critical. The economics of the actual product, technical risk, time to market, absolutely also important. Market potential, customer requirements, and then, so if you have a safe plant, then your cost and your risk are essentially the major issues to be addressed. And I think those have been major concerns around this project. In terms of stuff that has already been done that has value from the demonstration power plant that can be taken forward, one is the fuel. We do have an advantage over that. Reactor systems, the fuel handling system specifically, technology in terms of design of the Brayton cycle and control systems, etc. I won't run through all of them, but there's assets, there's codes and standards, simulators, the licensing process, lessons that have been learned, and also skills and research networks with other entities and relationships. Now, what is the way forward? Now, the new approach is to service both electricity and process heat with a single offering. It does hold merit, and you can reduce your technology and licensing risk by adopting the standard nuclear island approach, and you minimize the first-of-a-kind engineering, and you move towards known technology. Pebble fuel, that's where South Africa will retain the most intellectual capital and have a strategic advantage globally. So industrialization benefits will still accrue through the supply of certain key componentry on a global basis. And we know fuel handling is one of the areas where we do have an advantage. On this revised business model, which has been approved by the PVMR board, we need to consolidate a revised partnership strategy. And the company is busy preparing a revised business plan to present to the shareholders. And that's the PVMR. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions on either or both of them? Mr. Smith? Mr. Wang? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Yes. Can I just say, starting off with the electricity ESCOM presentation, my concern is that what you see in the reduction of the net output in energy tends to reflect in the cost of electricity when the application serves before NERSA one of these days. So, I put my head in the block for it, but we're going to see a dramatic increase in electricity. That goes without saying. Now, my concern is basically the following, that if you look at the year-on-year net energy sent out diagram you had a few minutes ago, the net usage of energy was less than that which was used during the load shedding period. Now that means a dramatic decrease in the amount of energy consumed. And I think you said basically it was due to possibly to people taking longer holidays. But I think that might be oversimplification of what the causes might be. You know, are there any more substantive causes for that major reduction? 7.2% is a major reduction and brings it nearly within the line of the 10% required by ESCOM initially and demand side management. So it's basically just the reasons, because that in itself is worrisome, not from a balance sheet perspective, but also from other issues as to, is this a continuous trend? Because if there's a continuous trend, it will reflect on the revenue side of ESCOM, no doubt. And then reflect on the consequential increase in cost for the consumer. So that's from, on the other side with PVMR, I'm not sure whether this is good news or bad news from the so-called S&I approach, which I still don't understand what that exactly is. I mean, could you just explain to me what the standard nuclear island approach is? I've never heard of it in my life. So, and that's on the one side. The second side is, there was a lot of talk about the safety aspect of the PVMR technology not being up to scratch, and what was one of the possible reasons why they've now kind of with a revised model. Secondly, there was a timeline of 2016, I think, when the new project would have been implemented at Kuberg's facility. What is the new timeline? Because this is a revised approach. By when, if any, is there a possible date as to when the revised approach would take practical effect? In other words, when can we see the spin-off, the real financial spin-off from a program like this?
Sorry, we've got 5 minutes
left,
so we've got other questions.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to just pose the next question very quickly.
Yes, the other question which I really wanted to ask is the amount of money spent and the expectation that this would be a new research-funded project seems to have been scaled down dramatically. Is that a true statement, or if not, could you indicate how I'm wrong in that regard?
Let me take Mr. Gololo, because you haven't asked a question before, and then I'll take Mr. Wang. Very briefly, Mr. Gololo, please.
Thank you very much, Jefferson. Actually, mine is on PBMR. I'm just interested on page 9, actually, where it's stated the level edge that will be taken forward with regard to the fuel, actually. I'll be interested in knowing as to how are they going to extract fuel out of this whole PBMR. And then also on the skills development, actually, whether they've already started with the process of recruiting, personnel that could be dealing with this aspect of PBMR in universities, in higher institutes of learning and all that. How far are they with regard to this skill development aspect? Thank you very much.
Chairperson, I think a lot of things being done, but what I wanted to find out was when did it come to DP's attention that of these technical challenges, because today we're being presented with a lot of technical challenges, which is not really what our portfolio is about. I think that's more for Minerals and Energy. Our portfolio is more about whether this is a business entity that can sustain itself, and that's why we must also find out when do we expect PBR to be to start treating itself as a business entity, rather than as far as I know at this stage it's still a research project. So we can't really quantify, we can't really evaluate it, SOE if itself it doesn't see itself as a business entity. That's what I wanted to find out. If DP has been brought to the anticipation of these technical challenges only 30 years, then we think that's understandable. So if it was prior this time, I was wondering how the cash flow projection statement has been approved with these challenges. The problem now is when do we realize all these technical problems? And I think the other thing I think I want to pause for that one.
You can always just afterwards just engage a little bit. But let me just add one or two questions. I'm not sure these guarantees, they were only a hell of a lot. I'm not quite sure. You mentioned with the 150 billion in terms of guarantees that there is a fee that attaches to it. Now, am I correct? So 150 billion merely enables ESCOM to go and lend money elsewhere at a premium interest rate, frankly. What's the benefit for ESCOM, really and truly speaking, given that you're not only having to pay for the guarantee, but you're also then paying your interest rate? And given that you've been downgraded, I guess that interest rate is not small change. So I'm not quite sure that I'm entirely comfortable. What is the department's view on guarantees as opposed to outright loans? I mean, it seems to me that you might as well lend from Treasury if that's the case, and pay it back, and hopefully you can save some money under those circumstances. These issues around the second, what do you call it? The radio nurses thing, what do you call it? NYCD. Sounds like a program. Okay, but these three issues around the access to borrowing assumptions, the CPIX issues, I mean, we've seen that before when the commodity prices just hit the roof, and these tariffs are simply, you know, the process doesn't take into account the fact that there's this huge uncontrollable, frankly, very much like the SAA story when it comes to fuel. And then they have to hedge, and obviously that goes wrong and so on. I mean, it just seems like it's a game of roulette that you play. I mean, I don't think that is something that either Minerals and Energy envisaged when we said NERSA should come into play. The idea with NERSA is to actually get some kind of certainty into the economics of the power utility. It seems to me it has exactly the opposite effect. I'm not sure what your views are, and maybe you can talk to us a little bit, and you know, hopefully the next colleagues will engage you more fully on those issues. And then lastly, I think with just to round up what other people are saying on PBMR, talk to us about timelines. Tell us, you know, are we going back? Do we have to go back to the drawing board if you're going to have all these other applications, or can we continue from where we were? Because that's the bottom line, really. And I know why it is that you've had to change focus, because frankly, you know, you don't have as much support as you would have previously had on this project. And I think we must be frank about it, and not necessarily convey that they're technical challenges, because they're not technical challenges that have not been envisaged. I think the problem is that you lack shareholder support on this particular application, that you're not going to get funding ad infinitum, even though it's a research and development project that holds, I think, enormous promise for the economy as a whole. But clearly they've had to change strategy and try and become economically viable as soon as possible. And the question is, does this actually do that?
I'll take some and then Chris will... I mean, I have to say the honourable member's question is so on the money, on the effects of a demand reduction and tariff. But it's the framework that we have, which looks at revenue required. And because it looks at revenue required, if your volume goes down, you must still get the revenue somehow. So the average tariff goes up. So it is definitely a source of concern. So the downturn in the economy, on the one hand, sure, does create greater room in the available capacity to hook on new customers and the rest of the line. But the downside of that means that there's a smaller consuming base which has to generate the revenue to ensure that we make the investments going forward. I, you know, one of the things that I think we have to deal with in the next administration, and we're actually doing work around that, is infrastructure funding in South Africa, where over generations we've effectively had an embedded subsidy in the economy and therefore did not, I suppose, allocate sufficiently somewhere, create a fund that would fund infrastructure in the future. And so now we're facing a situation where we've got to replace infrastructure, and we just don't have the pot of cash sitting somewhere else. I also want to jump to the point, Chair, that you raised about guarantees. In an ideal world, frankly, shareholders give shareholder loans if they feel that they don't want to use equity. And you are probably have difficulty getting debt in the market, or you're at the point where the debt-equity ratio is starting to get to a bit of an uncomfortable position. So more often than not, frankly, when we get guarantees, we would much rather get a shareholder's loan. In the case of Eskom, there's no doubt that we don't have, the fiscus doesn't have 150 billion, which is what we would have required basically to get to a point we would be able to get back into the market and raise debt directly ourselves. It is a cost that in the end feeds through to the cost of capital, which feeds through to operating costs, which will eventually feed through to the tariff at the end. It's the way that it is. And that's the rule system that we effectively do. I think in the case of Eskom, we understand that there was not much of an option. Why an Eskom guarantee is necessary, however, in this particular juncture, is to shore up Eskom's balance sheet because of the current global environment. There's a sense in that if we didn't have the 150 billion or the 175 billion, both for old and for new debt, we might have difficulty raising money in the market in South Africa or overseas. So this is an additional instrument to make sure that we are able to find the market when we get into the money when we get into the market. But the point that you raise is frankly a position that we would hold. The better position always is to grant a shareholder loan whenever you can. The point that you also raised is on the electricity side. The greatest source of volatility on the price of electricity, if we take away CapEx, because we must have a proper conversation around how we fund CapEx going forward because of the situation that we find ourselves in, is the volatility of primary energy. That's really the greatest problem that we have. There is a project that's underway between the Department of Mineral Energy Affairs, the coal industry, Eskom, and ourselves, that is working together to look at how do you ensure that there's a greater certainty on the price of electricity going forward. And frankly, the solution in part would be that the state starts via this mining company to hold its own coal rights, so that might be able to leverage or to force a different pricing framework in coal. But that is a problem. That's the greatest cost driver outside of the costs that arise because of the capital expenditure program. Why the review of PBMR? The point that the member makes about what it is one of the questions that we've grappled with for a long time. But I think we were at the stage we were pretty clear that one of the things is there were the elements of PBMR which were moving towards manufacturing. That's a project company that you were dealing with, where we were starting to manufacture some of the componentry for the demonstration power plant. However, there were parts of the project of PBMR which were still in research phase. The Braxton cycle, Chris was indicating, where a lot more work has to be done. So one of the things that we had to look at is how do you de-risk this project? And to be honest, the discussions that we've had with Cecil and some of the commentary that they've provided was extremely helpful in sort of like starting to chart an alternative path, which still in the future gets you to the epidemiology. Because let's not forget, the thing about the Brayton cycle is it lets you get to a point where you can have a high, it makes real the hydrogen economy. That we've never said is today. That has always been a 50-year from now position globally, not just in South Africa. But if you develop the technology yourself, you're in the future. That was the, sort of one was the central review. The other was a study that was undertaken by Treasury with the Dresdner Bank, which in the end came up with some seriously interesting ideas around how you could review the project and actually start thinking about it as a project that comes, that you bring to market some product sooner rather than later. And then you start doing trade-offs. What the trade-off is between this new formulation and the previous one is that we go for a lower temperature reactor. But it's not the, a very low, it's still a much one of the highest temperature reactors at its size. I think we're 200 degrees, 200 to 300 degrees higher in temperature than the standard. So we're still in a good ballpark. But the other advantage is that it then enables a quick a move towards a product. And the standard nuclear island is where you manufacture a standardized nuclear island, and it's based on known technology. So that limits also the project significantly from licensing for manufacture, because we're now taking technology that's existing and it's not new elements. There are new elements that we still have to work with because it is high temperature. It is a higher temperature than what would normally been had. So fundamentally, that's all the reject does. It gets us a product which can be licensed with a much greater degree of ease. It has less risks. There are some research elements that are still attached with because we still have to deal with helium at the end of the day. But we believe it's a project that's closer to market. And as Chris was indicating, we get comfortable. The Chinese and ourselves were developing the project in exactly the same fashion, where we were both looking at electricity first and then looking at other applications on the other side. Even the Chinese project has reviewed and gone to looking at process heat first and looking at joint applications which are steam and electricity at the same time. And that's why we have the view that at some future date, ESCOM might viably being a customer using on the electricity. The technical challenges, there are no new technical challenges. We've always had to do research. What this rejigging also does is that if you're able to bring commercial products to market sooner, it means that we also are able to have revenue that we can reinvest in the research elements going forward. The point that the chair makes, and I wanted to go back to that, you as a country we have a vision that says that we want to be an advanced manufacturing economy. You don't just become an advanced manufacturing economy. We've only got two advanced research projects in South Africa, and I'd say two-ish in a sense. It's the PBMR. The benefit of the PBMR is that its research is extensive. It's the areas in which it's building capacity is not narrow. It's advanced material manufacturing, pressurized manufacturing, high-temperature manufacturing, which are all skills that you require for the future at the end of the day. The other one that we have is the SKA. The square kilometer array. If we don't have these kinds of projects in South Africa, effectively we just become another manufacturing economy. Now, I don't need to remind you, and you can go and check that in effect for yourself, what's been happening to manufacturing growth in South Africa. Pretty dismal. And then you stand back and you look at the areas where there are blips of interesting growth. Watch the areas in which they come from. The point that Chris was making around fuel is that fuel is a competitive advantage that we have. The one of the most interesting things about the PBMR, other than the very high temperature, is because of its greater safety and also with proliferation, because of the fuel types that we have, is that we believe it's the one area where we have genuine IP, which is South African intellectual property. And it's an area that we'd like to make sure that stays not necessarily the South African state, but the South African economy are the lead participants in that area. Chris, I think I've answered you can, the timeline stuff and things like that. Well, let me help with this on that. What we were presenting to you, Chair, is a strategy that's approved by the PBMR board, which we have looked at and we are very comfortable with. And now the next steps have got to be for PBMR to come back and indicate what the revised business plan looks like. And then also an indication of then what are the revised timelines that we'll be sitting at. But they are progressing on EIA processes that we haven't lost. One of the things that the member asked was around skills development. Those are programs that are already in place with universities where we already are training. And the bias of the PBMR has always been to have a lot more black students on board. But it also provides opportunities for all students in South Africa because its areas of applications are pretty broad at present, I think.
Maybe I can just address from the standard nuclear island approach. Essentially, as DG said, you have a standard where the nuclear parties, and the original design was that you had this helium running through the reactor, everything, and then also going through the turbine that produces power. What you're talking about now is having a nuclear island that's almost separated, and you could put a standard generator on, or steam generator, power or steam generator. The other one was the decline in terms of consumption. We have had discussions with Eskom, and they actually have the evidence to show that a lot of the mines and some of the big smelters, etc., have reduced the production, and that's caused quite a big drop. But a lot of them have indicated that as soon as things pick up, they would then ramp back up, and it could happen very quickly. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot is due to the fact that for very many months now we've been saying paid electricity and early pictures, and they've actually had the engagement with the users as well. And so in a sense, a double-edged sword in one way. What I do want to just say quickly, DG, is certainly on PBMR and ESCOM, it seems to me that you're going to have to keep submitting reports to us, particularly on the ESCOM issue, even though we are all going to be in election mode trying to return. And hopefully what I think the department will have to do very early into the next administration, hopefully if you're still a department, even if you're not, is to do a full briefing for not just whether or not you have a portfolio committee, that's not the issue, but four members of parliament who come in next time around. I think a lot of work has been done, particularly with PBM. Mm-hmm. I think that there's, as with SAA, much misinformation doing the rounds on this particular project. And I do think that point that you make about do we want to be an advanced manufacturing country is the question to ask. Because if we do not share that vision, then we must know, you must know, up front. Because it doesn't help to continuously, move five steps forward and then three back. Because not everybody is bought into that vision. Lastly, let me just say, let me thank you all for coming, and I know you have to all rush off and so on. To members, thank you all for coming, particularly those members from other portfolios. I'm very glad to see that our invitation has been responded to in this way. I want to acknowledge the fact that this is our last meeting as Public Enterprises. I see that a number of you have already put your foot in the door. You're going to be directors of on the boards of big enterprises and so on. But I wish you the best of luck over the campaigning period. Let us all return safely, if not to Parliament, certainly to our homes. I wish you all very well, those of you who are travelling out and so on. And I hope to see most of you back again, because I think that IMU is a repository of enormous amount of experience, a wealth of knowledge and expertise even on some of these issues. A lot of you will understand some of the lingo that others will have to start learning. So I hope that institutionally there will be a retention of some of the memory. And for those of you who don't make it back, clearly you'll be earning, the bright side is you'll be earning a better wage wherever you go. So thank you very much. And Peter, sorry?
Chairperson, as the senior backbencher of this committee, and I, on behalf of the committee members, thank you also for the way in which you've led this committee and which you've chaired it. And also, you've already said to the department for the way in which they've interacted with us. But thank you very much, Chairperson, for what you've done.
Just convey to the ST of the ANC as well, so that I can be high up on the list. Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else want to say anything? Can we move for closure? Thank you very much, members. Travel safely.